Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Saturday, the 13th of May. The boss of the Russian mercenary group Wagner accuses the regular army of fleeing a Ukrainian advance near Bakhmut, saying they'd been routed. So has the Ukrainian counteroffensive started? Pope Francis has again criticised couples who have pets rather than children.
He said that the practice is a denial of fatherhood and motherhood and diminishes us. It takes away our humanity.
And Mexico says it will only allow 1,000 people a day to be deported into its territory from the US after an American rule change at the border. Also in the podcast, the desperate situation facing residents trapped in Sudan nearly a month into a brutal battle between two warring generals. And disappointment for Taylor Swift fans. Stay tuned to hear why. It was only a few days ago that President Volodymyr Zelensky told the BBC that Ukraine was not yet ready to launch its much-anticipated counter-offensive, as it was still waiting for some supplies. However, Ukrainian attacks around the battlefield city of Bakhmut have already pushed back some Russian forces. Ukraine says its troops have advanced about 2 kilometres. After first denying it, Russia later admitted that some of its soldiers had indeed retreated to what it called more favourable positions. Our correspondent in Kiev, Hugo Bechega, has been following developments.
The battle for Bakhmut is the longest in the war so far. For weeks, Russian troops were the ones advancing. Progress there was extremely slow and deadly. But now, it's Ukraine that's making gains. The authorities here say Ukrainian forces have pushed forward 1.5 miles on the southern edge of the city, and that Russia suffered heavy casualties. This could be the most significant advance for Ukraine in Bakhmut in months. Russia has been determined to seize the city, to have a victory to celebrate. Ukraine is defending it, trying to inflict losses on its enemy as it prepares a major counteroffensive. Roman Hirishenko is a Ukrainian commander in Bakhmut.
Our forces have had success near Bakhmut. Everyone's doing their job. Our task is to keep the enemy's main forces here as long as possible. It helps our comrades in other places to break through their defences. That's what we're doing.
From Russia, an apparent admission that its military had been pushed back. The defence ministry said troops had moved to what it described as more favourable positions. That, however, was dismissed by the head of the Wagner Group, which has been leading the Russian offensive in Bakhmut. Yevgeny Prigozhin, who was a vocal critic of the Russian army, said soldiers had in fact fled in a rout. If more ground was lost, he warned, Ukrainian forces could gradually encircle Bakhmut. In the nearby town of Soledar, there's been another apparent Ukrainian push, which Russia claimed to have repelled.
Hugo Bechega reporting from Ukraine. So is this the beginning of the long-promised Ukrainian counteroffensive? Our Europe regional editor is Danny Eberhardt.
Well, that's the big unknown, really, Ollie. Basically, there's been so much talk about this Ukrainian counteroffensive. When it happens, it'll be preceded by a whole series of feints by Ukraine to keep the Russians guessing where the main thrust may be. So, yes, it could be a prelude to a counteroffensive, or it could be a part of a wider counteroffensive itself to recapture Bakhmut. But the strategic significance of Bakhmut, imagine, are less important than other objectives. For example, the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, which is still under Russian control, or perhaps moving south to try to cut the land bridge that Russia uses to supply the occupied Crimean Peninsula.
And briefly, what do you make of these reports of big blasts in Luhansk, in Russian-occupied territory?
They're intriguing. Obviously, a day after Britain confirmed that it was supplying Ukraine with Storm Shadow cruise missiles, which can hit targets in excess of 250 kilometres away. Luhansk itself is very close to the Russian border, and it's not seen as much activity as, for example, a city like Donetsk in terms of direct combat. It's very much on the edge of where US HIMARS artillery systems can hit. So it's not clear whether this was a Storm Shadow attack or by something, some other weapon system, or even perhaps a drone.
Our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt. Elon Musk has finally revealed his successor as chief executive of Twitter. She's Linda Yaccarino, former head of advertising sales at media giant NBC Universal. On Thursday, Mr. Musk announced he'd hired a woman to replace him, but kept the name secret, fueling speculation. The BBC's North America business correspondent Michelle Fleury has the details.
Elon Musk once again took to his social media platform to confirm that his reign as CEO of Twitter has come to an end. The billionaire tweeted on Friday that Linda Yaccarino, the former head of ad sales at NBC Universal, will focus on business operations, leaving him to concentrate on product design and new technology. Mr. Musk also wrote, "Looking forward to working with Linda to transform this platform into X, the everything app." Elon Musk wants to expand Twitter's offering beyond chat to include functions like shopping or dating. Since he bought the social media platform for $44 billion in October, Twitter has laid off roughly three-quarters of its staff, and the money it makes from advertising has plunged. Brands paused their spending, fearful that the billionaire might weaken content moderation. But the incoming CEO, one of the biggest challenges, will be to woo them back.
Michelle Fleury, our North America business correspondent. Births have been declining in Italy for 14 years in a row now, dropping to record lows last year. Speaking at a conference on the shrinking Italian population, the Pope said that savage free market conditions were preventing young people from starting families. But he also returned to a previous complaint that many couples preferred to have pets instead of children.
15 giorni fa, l'audienza mercoledì.
2 weeks ago, during the Wednesday general audience, while greeting the faithful, I met a lady in her 50s. I greeted the lady. She opened a bag and asked me to bless her baby. There was a small dog. I lost my patience and upbraided her, saying, "Many children are hungry, and you bring me a dog?"
I heard more about the issue from our correspondent in Rome, Sofia Bettizza.
In Italy, there are more pets than people at the moment. Partly this was due to lockdown, but also this research shows, interestingly, that Italians who own pets often have a better quality of life. Now, when it comes to the comments that Pope Francis made, this is actually not the first time that he talks about this. Last year, he said that people who choose to have pets over children are acting selfishly. He said that the practice is a denial of fatherhood and motherhood and diminishes us. It takes away our humanity.
So he's doubled down on his complaints about pet ownership, but the Pope also spoke about the difficulty that young people in Italy have in having families. What was he talking about there?
That's right. He said today at a conference in Rome that starting a family in Italy is becoming a titanic effort that only the rich can afford. You know, he talked about difficulty in finding a stable job, sky-high rents and low wages, saying that all of these are real problems. And he urged politicians in Italy to find a solution. Italy has one of the lowest fertility rates in the EU, and it's a real problem. Last year, births dropped below 400,000, which is a new low.
And he was sitting alongside the Italian Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni. What does he want the authorities to do and what can they do?
That's right. Giorgia Meloni today said that Italy's plummeting birth rate is a national emergency. And she said that fixing this problem is an absolute priority of her government. She has done a few things already. When she became prime minister, she created a ministry to address the issue of declining birth rates.
And if Italy is facing a demographic crisis, why is there so much concern over the number of migrants arriving? Because couldn't that help be part of the solution?
This is a right-wing government. In fact, it's the most right-wing government that Italy has had since World War II, when, you know, Mussolini was in power. They have a very strong stance on migration, and they've said time and time again that this is not the solution to the problem. If anything, a government minister very close to Meloni came under fire a few weeks ago for saying that Italians are at risk of ethnic replacement because of all the migrants that are coming in. So they definitely don't see that as part of a solution. They see that as part of a problem.
Sofia Bettizza in Rome. The United Nations says that around 200,000 people have now fled Sudan since the outbreak of violence last month. More airstrikes and artillery fire were reported in the capital Khartoum on Friday, despite an agreement to protect civilians reached by the rival Sudanese armies in talks in Saudi Arabia. A ceasefire has not yet been declared, as Barbara Platusha reports.
For nearly a month, Sudan's warring generals have been battling for control of Khartoum. It's a brutal power struggle between the army and paramilitary troops. Both of them think they can win. But the conflict has trapped civilians in desperate conditions.
You're in constant worry that you be laying in bed and a bomb will fall into you and break your building or bomb your house.
Hashim is stuck in Khartoum because he lost his passport before the war. It's been a nightmare.
Every time you hit an airplane, every time you hit a bomb, you be on edge, on your toes. That's a feeling that I don't want anybody to feel.
But there is a glimmer of hope at talks in Jeddah mediated by the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. The two sides have reached an agreement. They promised to protect civilians and allow delivery of aid. Now they have to secure a truce so that can actually happen. Saudi Arabia's Deputy Foreign Minister Walid al-Khareji welcomed the deal and said he hoped it would lead to a permanent end of the conflict, but that looks completely out of reach. In the streets of Khartoum, it's a battle for survival, a constant hunt for dwindling supplies. Here, people gather outside one of the few shops still open. They're short of food and medicine. Hospitals are barely functioning. Some can't bury their dead because of the fighting.
My name is Azhar Shilgami. Grandfather's name is Abdullah Shilgami. Grandmother's name is Alawiya Rishwan.
Azhar Shilgami has been watching with horror from New York. Any truce would come too late for her family.
My grandparents cannot leave the area because there's snipers all over the region and it's right next to the military HQ. Anyone that's stuck inside the center of Khartoum right now or has tried to escape has been hit by snipers.
Azhar's grandparents got stuck in the heat of the fighting. Her grandfather, a British citizen, was shot, leaving her disabled grandmother alone at home. Weeks of frantic phone calls failed to get help. 3 days ago, Azhar heard she was dead.
They called me and they were like, oh, we're sorry to tell you, but she's passed away. And then I called back again. I'm like, maybe she's in a coma. Maybe she, you know, did you check her pulse? And then he tells me that her body's been decaying. So it's quite painful to think that she was alone with no electricity in the midst of, it's really hot in Sudan right now, in the midst of the heat with bombs, waking up to bomb sounds of ammunition.
The British embassy is across the road from the house, but Azhar says they didn't respond to her pleas. And the evacuation point was at an airfield her grandparents couldn't reach.
If the British embassy is able to bring in cars, evacuate their staff that are stuck inside, surely they can drop off water at least. Or surely they can come pick up. It's literally just picking up one of your citizens.
Agonized questions and ongoing misery. The fighting still hasn't stopped, and at night, power cuts blanket the capital with blackness. Unless this deal is serious, things will get worse quite quickly.
Barbara Platusha with the latest on events in Sudan. Mexico says it will only allow 1,000 people a day to be deported back into its territory from the US after the expiry of American COVID-era restrictions on migrants. The Title 42 measures had allowed the US authorities to immediately deport those who were undocumented. The Mexican government has closed dozens of migrant processing centres and ordered the immigration agency there not to issue any more transit visas. With more details, here's our Mexico correspondent, Will Grant.
The Mexican Foreign Minister, Marcelo Ebrard, said that Mexico would not accept more than 1,000 deportees a day from the US and assured that even at the height of Title 42 expulsions, only took in a maximum of 16,000 in a single month. Mr. Ebrard produced figures on the number of migrants currently waiting in northern border cities, including 10,000 in Ciudad Juarez, which were noticeably below the figures quoted by US officials a day earlier. Secondly, President Andrés Manuel López Obrador announced that the country's immigration agency, the INM, had been instructed not to issue any more transit visas to immigrants wanting to head north. Coupled with the closure of 33 temporary processing centres for such transit visas, hundreds of migrants have been left frustrated and stuck in the southern city of Tapachula on Mexico's border with Guatemala. Mr. López Obrador recently confirmed several thousand more National Guard troops had been sent to the southern states around the lifting of Title 42 to add to the more than 25,000 military personnel already there.
Will Grant. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
It's about reforming the military, the monarchy, for a democratic future. It has struck a chord not just with young people, even older demographics now.
Will Thai voters turn their back on the military-led government? Three days after being arrested over corruption allegations, Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan has been welcomed by cheering supporters as he arrived back in his home city of Lahore after the High Court in Islamabad released him from custody. Mr. Khan complained about being kept at the court for hours against his will, despite having been granted protective bail earlier on Friday. He's expected to appear in court again on Monday. The opposition leader's dramatic arrest on Tuesday sparked outrage among his supporters, leading to days of violent protests, several deaths and hundreds of arrests. Our South Asia regional editor Anbarasan Etirajan has this assessment of the past few days of turmoil.
What Pakistan witnessed this week was extraordinary. The government and the country's powerful army have once again failed in their attempts to keep Imran Khan, who is facing dozens of cases, in prison. For now, Mr. Khan, aided by favourable court rulings, appears to have outmaneuvered his opponents. His brief detention led to days of violent protests. Mr. Khan's supporters upped the stakes by ransacking a military commander's residence in Lahore, and a crowd broke into the army at quarters in Rawalpindi. Mr. Khan said the scenes from the streets were not unexpected.
The way they picked me and kidnapped me from there. The army picked me up. So, what do you think? There'd be no reaction?
Mr. Khan and the military have long been at loggerheads. Some feared that the army, that has ruled for nearly half the country's 75-year history, might intervene again following the unrest. But a military spokesman said the army supported the democratic process and dismissed reports of dissent in the ranks following recent events. The turmoil is bad optics for a country that's staring at an economic crisis. It will only add to doubts over the chances of obtaining a bailout loan from the International Monetary Fund.
Our South Asia editor Anbarasan Etirajan. The Australian government has given the go-ahead to a new coal mine despite coming to power last year on a platform of climate action. The Isaac River mine in Queensland is expected to produce about 2.5 million tonnes of coal over 5 years, but at a cost of 7 million tonnes of greenhouse gases over its lifetime, according to some analysts. Sarah Hanson-Young is a senator for the Green Party in South Australia. She spoke to Rebecca Kesby.
We're extremely disappointed. Not only is this a further expansion of fossil fuels in Australia, but it also happens to be a mine that's in an area that is important for our wildlife. It's on critical habitat of the Australian koala, for example.
But for their part, the government, which only came in last year, is saying that they've not been able to stop this development because it was already underway. And to be able to stop it, they'd have to be able to prove and have evidence that it was going to cause a huge detrimental impact to the emissions that it would bring out. And there's also the argument, isn't there, that it is going to make it easier to create steel for the transition to renewable power sources.
Look, these are all obviously issues that the government here in Australia is dealing with. One of the big problems is that our environment laws in Australia don't take into consideration the climate pollution or the impact on climate. So when the federal government is confronted with having to give the green light or to reject certain proposals, they can't actually assess the climate damage, and that's a problem. Australia is one of the largest exporters of coal and gas in the world. We don't actually need any new mines being opened up. Every time you expand, it's much harder to deal with the pollution that already exists.
So how could the government have handled this particular issue then?
The government could have rejected this by virtue of taking a stronger stand, notwithstanding.
A stronger stand where?
The minister needs to give herself the powers to reject these types of projects and these types of mines. The moment they're standing by and simply saying, oh, well, it's out of our hands. Well, no, you're the government of the day. You have the power to change the laws. After the last election here in Australia, the parliament has now got more MPs, senators, politicians, political parties that care about climate change and the environment more than any other time in Australian history. There is the will in the parliament if the government wants to take that.
And are there more projects such as this coal mine in the pipeline for Australia? And how do you intend to fend those off?
Yes, there's 116 coal and gas projects currently on the books. The Australian government has the opportunity to knock these back, to implement stronger laws and to stand up to the big fossil fuel companies.
Sarah Hanson-Young talking to Rebecca Kesby. On Sunday, the people of Thailand will vote in an election that many see as an opportunity to break free from the military-led government that's been in power for almost a decade. The Prime Minister, Prayut Chan-o-cha, who led the coup in 2014, is seeking another term of office. But he faces a strong challenge from two anti-military parties who are sensing a desire for change. This report from our Southeast Asia correspondent, Jonathan Head.
For weeks, this catchy tune has been blaring out from the roving campaign trucks of the Pheu Thai Party. A landslide for Pheu Thai, it urges, to improve the people's lives. As it has been in every election held this century, the political movement founded by former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat is the front runner, and by a large margin. This time, the party has chosen Thaksin's youngest daughter, Petong Tan, to lead it. She campaigned into the last stages of her pregnancy. Since the two coups, she tells this rally, our country's development has stalled, referring to the military takeovers, which deposed governments led by her father and her aunt. Previous iterations of the party were dissolved by the courts and its leaders banned from politics. If it wins big this time, everyone expects some kind of extra-parliamentary move to block it.
Of course, I do believe we can form the government because I'm asking for fairness. And I think like the people want to see like a better politics, better solution for the country, not just the coup d'etat.
But you're prepared for the possibility that some method will be used to stop you.
I have high hope that something like that is not going to happen again.
But Pheu Thai's dominance of the political stage is facing a new competitor. Move Forward, a party formed only 5 years ago, has captured the imagination of younger voters in particular, with its diverse slate of youthful, idealistic candidates. This is Chontichha Jengru, who was one of the most prominent protesters against military rule. Now she wants to move from the street to parliament.
If we want to change the country, we also need to work in the parliament. I really want to bring all the demands from the people movement on the street.
Thai politics has been dominated by the military and the monarchy over decades.
Thitinampong Sudarak at Chulalongkorn University believes there is a public appetite now in Thailand for Move Forward's radical agenda, which includes limiting the power of the military and even the monarchy.
It has struck a chord not just with young people, even older demographics now. They've been captivated by the Move Forward agenda that Thailand needs to change. And the change is really not about having another coup, because that's a change backwards. It's about reforming the military, the monarchy, for a democratic future with better economic performance.
And what of the coup leader himself, Prayut Chan-o-cha? General Prayut is still popular with many older Thais, but his new ultra-conservative party is struggling to gain traction.
This system doesn't work anymore. We need a change. Military should stop intervening in politics.
This young lawyer, who did not want to use her name, says she applauded General Prayut's coup 9 years ago. She says she used to believe that a military government would be better than an elected one.
We need someone who is smart and brave enough to change the whole system. And I think Move Forward is the one.
All the polls point to the two pro-reform anti-military parties winning a clear majority between them in parliament. But this being Thailand, no one is sure whether that would be enough to allow a reformist government to take office.
Our Southeast Asia correspondent, Jonathan Head. Now, an update on the mystery book we reported on in the Global News podcast this time yesterday. Despite having no title or known author, the work quickly became a bestseller in the US weeks before its publication date. Fans of the singer Taylor Swift believed it was her surprise memoir. The real author has now been revealed a month early. So who is it? Chantal Hartle has this report.
It is honestly everything that I've wanted from Taylor basically since I started listening to her, just because I think the way she writes is just so beautiful and so powerful. So I feel like one day I'm hoping she'll write a tell-all memoir if this isn't already the case.
For Taylor Swift's most devoted fans like Kelsey Barnes, there were high hopes their favourite star was about to give them something they've waited a long time for. Swifties, as they're known, thought the singer had given clues about a memoir in her music and her recent social media posts, especially as this book is due to be released on July the 9th, a date Taylor mentions in one of her songs. It's currently the number one pre-ordered book for some American publishers. While Swifties may now be disappointed, another fan base is likely to be very happy. Publishers have announced the book is in fact about the South Korean pop group BTS and their rise to fame. They're one of the most successful boy bands in music history, with number one singles in more than 100 countries. The group is currently on a break while its members complete mandatory military service in South Korea. The publication date, the 9th of July, is also significant for BTS, the date their fan base officially became known as the Army in 2013. Some bookshops said they would refund Swifties who pre-ordered the book if it transpired that Taylor was not the author. And with copies selling for $45, it could be a considerable loss for stores if they do follow through with that.
Chantal Hartle. After months of preparation, Liverpool in northwest England is poised for its night in the international spotlight, hosting the final of the Eurovision Song Contest. The UK is staging this year's event on behalf of the 2022 winner, Ukraine, which is still under attack from Russia. Our entertainment correspondent Colin Patterson has been speaking to Eurovision fans in Liverpool.
One day to go to the grand final, and in the city centre, the length of the queue into the official merchandise shop had passed the hour mark.
What are you waiting for?
Socks.
What kind of socks?
Ukrainian, Liverpool, they need to match my Turin 2022 socks. Need socks.
Liverpool is seriously busy, already easily surpassing its target for visitor numbers, according to the city's Director of Culture, Claire McCogan.
I think it's going to be a lot more than 100,000. It's just been full of the most joy and loudness and compassion that only Liverpool could show the world. And I'm so proud of this city and so proud of everyone who's taken part in this incredible, incredible event.
And this afternoon, this Eurovision dance class at St Nicholas Catholic Academy was part of a programme to make sure children feel involved. Mike Helnia, Kukachuk's 8-year-old son Mikhail, goes to the school. They fled Ukraine last year.
It's good that if you can't host it, your friend will host it. You know, it's really good. Very warm feeling, like a piece of your home is here now with you, and it's like really a huge support.
Over at the arena, rehearsals for the final have begun. Ukraine's entry is the electronic duo Chvorchi. While outside, the volunteers simply don't want Eurovision to be over. Jan Swan has lived in the city all her life.
I thought I loved my city. I've seen through a tourist size, and it's just beautiful, the most amazing city ever. I just love it.
Eurovision truly is bringing people together.
Colin Patterson. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast this time tomorrow. This edition was mixed by Lewis Alsop and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.